Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Season 3 of the Fanfiction Tapes. I'm your host today, Maya, pronouns she, her, and today I'm joined by...
I forgot to write something funny this week. I'm Dylan, he, him.
And we don't have a guest this week, so it's just me, your friendly neighborhood producer, Ian, pronouns he, him.
Today's topic is all about what our favorite authors do or did poorly. It's really common for critiques to be leveled at authors we dislike, or for this critique to be a sign that an author is quote-unquote bad. So we want to mix things up a little bit with this episode, and specifically critique things about authors we like and enjoy. The authors that I'm going to be mentioning during today's episode are authors that I will genuinely recommend to other people, including having recommended only a few minutes before starting the recording. Or, well, trying to get everyone in the call for the recording.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we begin?
I suppose so.
Who do we talk about first? And explain what makes us mold.
Might as well start at the beginning here.
Yeah. The first one I wrote down for this, at least of the authors that I wanted to talk about, was J.R.R. Tolkien, known for... saying way too much information about any given thing, giving us paragraphs of exposition per thing that no one really cared about. And yeah, that's definitely something he has a reputation for, and I would agree is something he does. It can definitely distract a reader from the material.
Yeah. This is one of those situations... one of those situations that I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, where I do think that Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy movies are actually better in terms of the storytelling, pacing, and writing than the original books. And I enjoy the original books very much, but there is... so much extra lore dumping going on that really is not entirely necessary for advancing the story. And as a world builder, I can sympathize very much with Mr. Tolkien here. Like, the impression that I've gotten from Lord of the Rings is that he invented the languages first, and then invented a world to explain how the languages came about, and then decided to use that world to tell stories in?
Yeah, the opening of the Virgin of the Hobbit that I have talks, the first like text about the book you see in it is about the scripts used for the different languages, and Dwarfish versus Dwarvish.
But they are ways of, like, incorporating, like, lore and things and, like, better ways to deliver exposition. Like, you can do this in entertaining ways, and, you know, a different author might incorporate some of those things into the main narrative, even if it's just, you know, like poetry, making it rhyme. As Mr. Lucas would say.
Yeah, I actually like the way that one of the next authors on the list deals with giving lore, and that's Terry Pratchett, and that he gives, like, a decent amount of footnotes. They're not, I would say, really particularly required to understand what's going on, and they're often quite funny, which is why I usually read them.
Amusing and informative. And I think it's something that he often shares with Douglas Adams. Although I might just be misremembering that.
No, I think Douglas Adams also does that. It's been a while since I've read any of his works. But I do believe that is something he did.
So, what is the issue here?
One of the issues with Pratchett is that a couple of times he... Well, it's particularly that he makes a particular mistake, and that he uses a certain pop culture image of a goblin that is, well, it's problematic. It uses the stereotypes used to describe Jewish people. Long, hooked noses, greedy, that sort of thing, which are just flat out not true. And the dehumanization of Jewish people through the use of these tropes in media is a big problem. And it's also pretty prolific in fantasy. A lot of times, like the case of Terry Pratchett, it's not very intentional. As soon as he realizes what he'd done, he does correct that in another work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in the instance, like, in my mind, not every author does that. It's just more, oh, this is how goblins are generally described by other authors, not realizing that those authors may have been presenting it in a way to, you know, have the Jewish allegory in there.
Yeah, I think generally most, the way most authors use this is not at all intentional. It is just mindless. It's there, it's the status quo. You don't think to question why it is the way it is. You just use what is.
Yeah. You play with these standard tropes without questioning them, and you end up sticking your foot in your mouth.
Yeah, because, sorry, but it's like you don't realize that these standard tropes were intended or unintentionally the original author who, you know, made these tropes, it kind of made them in a problematic way. And you are repeating them. And that's a problem.
Yeah, one of the things I think, if we're also giving it advice, is like, question what's normal when you're writing a certain commonly used trope. Like, why is it done this way? Because you can, if you don't do this, you can pretty easily accidentally stumble into some pretty yikes shit.
Mm.
The other author that you've got listed here for doing this sort of thing is Rick Riordan.
Yes, and with Rick Riordan, I think it's pretty much always just a case of head empty. He's not necessarily thinking about doing it that way. Rick Riordan was one of the first, like, authors to go very mainstream with a depiction, an intentional depiction of ADHD that's, like, it's okay to be different. I remember growing up, reading his books, and feeling a little bit less alone. Now, granted, I didn't know I had ADHD at the time, and the way Rick Riordan now depicted, like, looking back now at what he wrote in the early 2000s, it's kind of yikes. The way he talks about ADHD is that of someone who doesn't themselves have it and is only really experienced with the way ADHD is commonly perceived and the way that folks who don't have ADHD interact with our symptoms. But he did make a genuine attempt, and he learned from it. A lot of the mistakes that he made in The Lightning Thief, he doesn't make when retelling that same story in the show, which I have seen and I do recommend. I think it's really enjoyable. It's pretty different from the books, but I think they make it work for the very different time that this story is being told in.
And shout out to my boy, Adam Copeland, who plays Ares.
He was a good pick for Ares. I'm going to grab the quote that one of my friends said because I think it's funny.
Go ahead.
My friend Pedge, they f***ing nailed the casting on Ares. Looks like a biker dude with just a hint of white nationalist. And I do think he was a perfect cast for Ares. I really liked the way they had Ares in the show. But that's too much talking nice things about people we like. Let's say some more mean things.
Yeah, let's bring their egos down a bit. I think when you're trying to depict something and you don't really understand it, you can often get that sort of foot in mouth thing. But I think all that's important is once you realize these mistakes, first off, hope your mistakes aren't terrible or egregious enough. You know what I mean? Like, I hope you haven't accidentally said something really bad is the first part. The second part is once you find out, try to just educate yourself and fix those mistakes when you go again. Like, and I think that's obviously what's happened in this situation.
I think something as well is just own up to it and go, yeah, I f***ed up.
Yeah. And then go, now watch me write it better next time. Because you can always do that. That's the thing when you're an author is just do it better next time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And both Pratchett and Riordan have a track record of doing it better next time.
Yeah, Riordan did really poorly with his gay characters originally. He fucked up big time. And then he did better the next time around. Next time he included them.
I do also think that it is a lot easier to fall into this trap if not so much when you don't know as much, but when you think you know and you don't.
Yeah, when you have assumptions.
That's a blind spot that's a lot harder to spot in advance.
Like, yeah, that's probably like day one of engineering as we go, all right, cool, you think you're hot shit, you think you're smart. And because a lot of folks that get into engineering have historically had pretty good grades and generally do think they're hot shit, myself included. But you have to acknowledge that there is a lot you don't know, and you do not know how much you don't know because you don't know it.
Yeah, like
there are the known unknowns and there are the unknown unknowns.
Like, even if, you know, say we were to write something that we are very familiar with, like if I was to write about autism as someone who is on the spectrum, it's still, I don't know everything about other people's. Like, I can only describe my own experiences. So it's like, that's why you can never make a sweeping sort of statement about it, whatever. Like, just try your best. Like, basically, try and put in some effort. Even if you're confident, it doesn't hurt to, you know, double check things or ask people. You can delay your book by a few days, you know. let someone else have a quick read through or ask questions.
Yeah, I think it's definitely along those lines. Important to remember, no one group of people is a monolith. You're not gonna get the same answer when you ask 10 different people of a group what their experiences as a member of that group have been. Whether you're asking college students what their experience with college is, autistic people what their experience with being neurodivergent is, whether that's trans people and their gender. Hell, whether it's people in their own personal politics. People are people, and people don't fit into boxes very well.
Yeah, it's like, you know, hypothetically, a trans person who had a very easy time transitioning, hypothetically, couldn't not write as accurately the experiences of someone who went through a very difficult time or a different period in their lives transitioning. You know, it's sort of like in that instance, you have to do research. While you're starting with a higher baseline than someone else, but you still got to put in work. Don't assume you can just go in and be like, yeah, I know everything here. I lived through part of it. It's like, yeah, that's the important part. You haven't got the entire breath to write out this story. You have most of it, but
you don't have all of it.
Yeah, you don't have more than someone who has talked to a trans person or multiple trans people who had difficult periods during their transition, a cis person who has, you know, had that education will have more than you than a trans person who didn't have or ask others about that experience. So yeah, education tops all. Who would have thought? Learning is good.
This just then, breaking news.
Be smart.
The more you know.
Accept education into your life.
All right, we are a little bit off track. And to get us back on track, let's bully someone who has actually had this leveled as a point of critique against them many a time and is also beloved by Ian and myself, Brandon Sanderson.
They keep on telling me this guy is going to write Game of Thrones, and I keep telling them, no, the Expanse guy is.
I mean, you're probably right about that. I think the reason that people keep memeing about Brandon Sanderson writing Game of Thrones is because
he finished Wheel of Time.
Yeah, exactly. The big fantasy epic series of the 90s on the subject of letting your story get too big to write. Jeez. You're saying George R. R. Martin has a problem with that, and we'll get to that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So what is the issue with Mr. Sando Brando?
The thing that he gets critiqued for a lot, and I think it's an accurate critique, is that his prose can be kind of weak. And I would agree that, yeah, his prose is not the best. It's not... I wouldn't say it's really anything to write home about. It's, you know, competently done. I've read worse. Which is kind of damning with faint praise. But that's not why I read Brandon Sanderson, so, you know, I don't really care that much. I'm there for the other things. I'm there for the happening, as I tend to call it.
Do you wish it was just a little bit different sometimes? A little bit more spice? Or is it too milquetoast for you?
The thing with Sanderson's prose is it's functional.
And that is something that I want to say about the critiques we're leveling here. The things we're talking about is that none of these make an author bad. They can sometimes make certain aspects of their work harder to read, depending on your preferences as a reader. But every author, and that's part of why we're picking on these authors that we like, is gonna have stuff they don't do as well.
Yeah, nobody's perfect.
In a couple of instances here, it's like, here's things in the past that they did bad. They're kind of a lot better now.
Yeah, there's... Bring it back to Pratchett for a minute, there's a reason that people say don't start with the first books in the Discworld series.
Yeah, and that's part of why I don't recommend people start with Brandon Sanderson's first book, because it is easily his weakest. Elantris is one of his earlier novels, I believe, in terms of when he originally wrote it, as well as when it was actually published. And it suffers for that. It's not a bad book. I enjoyed reading it. But if I want someone to like The Cosmere, I'll suggest that they read The Way of Kings or Mistborn Era 1.
Yeah.
So, who's next on the chopping block?
Swinging on the topic of prose and kind of swinging around into a different direction here. Tamsin Muir.
Jinx.
So, whereas Brandon Sanderson typically has very functional prose, Tamsin verges on purple prose sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
There are very few authors where I have been glad to be reading it as an ebook simply so that I can highlight the words and look them up in a dictionary.
Yes, that is a big problem with Tamsin Amir's writing. That's the most common thing I see friends I recommend it to say is that, goddamn, I keep having to stop and look up these f***ing words.
And speaking as someone who, as a kid, actually read the dictionary for fun sometimes.
Yeah, I did that. I got in trouble for doing that in class. I lost dictionary privileges.
I mean, we were given dictionaries in school. I went to a Welsh school. We needed them. We wrote everything in Welsh, okay? We didn't know every word.
I wish I went to a bilingual school.
So, yeah, but yeah, we get it, Tamsin. You can use a thesaurus. You know what a synonym is. Good job.
And I mean, it fits for the characters, especially for the first two books, that they would use big, long, fancy words that they probably only saw by looking in a thesaurus. Most of the, like, first 10 characters we meet, like, at least 5 of those first 10 we meet, I would absolutely suspect of doing that were they real people.
Mm.
And so, from a character standpoint, it makes sense. Well, not even necessarily that they're smart, but that they want to sound smart.
Palamedes would do it unintentionally. Ianthe would do it on purpose. So would Harrow.
Harrow and Gideon would both do it on purpose, each to annoy the other.
Mm-hmm.
Crux is older than Seth. Than several of those words. Yeah, that's... I mean, Tamsin Muir is still a phenomenal writer. Like, I really genuinely do think she is one of the better writers writing today, but the fancy words, kind of a bit much.
We all want a monkey brain sometimes. Don't make us work for it. your thing is too smart for us. Dumb it down.
That is one of the most common things I see about people who feel like they can't read the Locked Tombs because they feel like they're not smart enough for it. And I think that the big long words contributes to that, unfortunately.
So, who are we on to now?
There's someone I wanted to mention, Jim Butcher, who I enjoy his works. I really like them. They're fun for me.
It has been a minute since we've nerded out over the Dresden Files on here.
It has. Butcher's also got some problems. A couple of them. There's a few moments of men writing women. There is what can be sometimes an annoying amount of Christian God this, Christian God that.
It happens.
I mean, it's fantasy. This stuff happens, and he's far from the only author to do this. And he's got a thing where, like, a lot of the female characters that are supposed to be attractive have green eyes. It's a little weird. My mom pointed it out to me when I finally convinced her to get past the first book. Because she's a bit of a weenie and couldn't handle the exploded corpses. But I knew she would probably really like the books, and I was right. Ian, have you read the newest Butcher books, or specifically Dresden Files?
There hasn't been anything that's come out since...
like 2020.
Yeah, so I'm caught up on the series.
All right, cool. You might have to, like, bleep this out in the final version, because this is spoilers. But my mom, like, wanted to throw the books at me when...
Understandable.
I gave her no warning and then just, like, cackled.
Yeah, no, understandable, because I read that, and my reaction can be summed up in... Jim Butcher, when I get you. When I get you, Jim. Have you read his other works?
I have, although I've read Codex Alara and Cinder Spires, although it has been a while. Wait a minute. Yeah, okay, there's another book out in the Cinder Spires, and I mean, I'm going to Amazon right now.
Cursed.
$20.
That's a lot of dollars.
I guess I'm making another after work stop at Skullface Books and Vinyl.
I really shouldn't spend money right now. Because I'm going to Colorado and Minnesota soon.
Interesting. However, places.
Book.
Well, you consider that. Is there anyone else we need to...
But also consider book.
Ugh.
Now, I don't think... Okay, the... Yeah, I don't think I ever noticed the green eyes thing before. It's interesting. That might be a case of, you know, when the...
author's poorly hidden kink.
Yeah. The author's poorly disguised fetish being a little more poorly disguised than usual.
Yeah.
Brief mention of Stephen King here on that topic. King is a very prolific author, but, like, all of his stories are set in Maine and feature an alcoholic...
Some mostly writers.
But what I really wanted to bring up here is Kingisms, where for just a moment, a character will turn into a sock puppet, very obviously, and say something completely out of character that is typically cringe and weirdly horny.
Uh-huh.
I don't really have anything else here. I could look up some examples, but I really don't want to.
Yeah.
So.
Ooh. Does T. Kingfisher have anything we could talk about today?
I mean, there's another author we haven't really talked about yet. Before we go on to other authors. Come on, Maya.
I can't really think of anything on T. Kingfisher on short notice. You know, nobody's perfect. I could probably come up with something eventually, but...
I'm just
Dylan,
nodding.
Go ahead and take the soapbox.
I mean, I've talked many times about Mr. George. Besides for the biggest issue that he doesn't write the books, but it's not really... People don't know the reason. First off, he's distracted. He's doing a bunch of Hollywood stuff, which is what he always wanted to do. But it wasn't until his book got really popular that he was able to do it without, like, problems. So yeah, now he gets to do all that. But besides that, is his story's gone too big and not in... And it's in the sense that he had a plan. That plan is like, okay, that seems fairly easy to write. And then that plan went out the window, and he's been sort of ad-libbing since 2002. Around then. He's been just going, oh yeah, this is sort of how I think about it, but, you know.
Wait, he's been ad-libbing for the last 22 years?
Kinda, yeah. Basically, he had a plan in, like, 94, 95, and that's kind of how the first book goes. By some point in probably, like, 98, he thought, this book is getting a bit bigger, because I only planned on a trilogy, but that's fine. And still write it. And then, probably by the time he was in the middle of Storm of Swords, he was like, I'm not going to be able to do what I planned, so now I've got to write another book in between. And then he always planned on, like, names, and then it's like, well, where did this book come from? You didn't plan this book. And that's sort of the problem, is now he says, okay, we're going to have, I think it's 7. That's what he says right now. He says, it's going to be 7. It's not going to be 7. You cannot finish this in 2 books. You've made it too big. Too many plot lines, too many characters. And not that that is usually a problem, and that's what makes his work so good. But if you're going to slap your metaphorical dick on the table, you got to have the confidence that you're able to keep it out there for long enough. Maybe because, you know. And also, this guy is also writing like an anthology book, and he's also writing novellas, also based in the same world at the same time, and also like helping to make all this other crap. Come on, George, write the main series. I have other issues with the writing. At times, it is sort of, first off, the character ages. Let's talk about that. George R. R. Martin does not understand ages. Are you guys aware of this?
I can't say I've ever read anything by Martin, so...
So, George R. R. Martin doesn't understand ages, because... First off, he presumes a lot about medieval history that is just not correct. Sort of like, oh yeah, girls were, you know, sort of having kids at 13. It's like...
What?
He's basically, like, got this idea in his head of how sort of the medieval times were, where it's like, oh yeah, the, you know, 12-year-old brides and all this, but, you know, they weren't... Not, it wasn't common. Like, there are probably instances of it, but it's not like, oh yeah, this is just a thing we do.
If I'm remembering what I've read on this correctly, that whole issue of you know, early teenage brides was more of a aristocratic thing, and even in those cases, you know, the marriage would not be consummated until like the bride was, you know, old enough for a pregnancy to be safe-ish?
Yeah, it would be like an instance, it's like, well, they were actually like encouraged because they figured, oh yeah, it kind of hurts women more to give birth early. Like,
yeah, and...
Let's just have it right. Humans are not as needlessly cruel as Martin writes them to be. I feel like that's like one of my big issues with it, is like, why is everyone such a fucking asshole? Like, he writes a majority of characters like they're the dumbest people around, and also the meanest, most cynical people. And you're just kind of like, uh-huh. But yeah, it's also just like, he doesn't understand character age. It's like, John and Rob are, like, I think 15, 16. Like, that's their age. And, like, everyone who's younger than them is sort of, like... I think, like, Sansa's, like, 13. Bran's, like, 10. Arya's, like, 9. And I think, like, Rickon's, like, 3. And in the show, they pretty much add like 3 or 4 years to everyone to make it make sense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then they just age the parents up like by 10 years. Because I think Ned Stark is like mid-30s, whereas like, you know, Sean Bean is like portraying a guy in his mid to late 40s, like early 50s sort of thing. So that's like the change in adaptation, you know? But it also does show this guy does not, like, he does not understand ages, and, like, you're writing this 8-year-old like a fucking 13-year-old, you know?
Yeah. I think at this point he's probably semi-intentionally planning on doing a Robert Jordan. Mm-hmm. He's just going to let the clock run out and, leave somebody else to figure out how to write out of his corner.
I think he'll finish Winds, but I don't think he'll get beyond that. He'll do Winds of Winter, just because I think he's like 3/4 done.
That's good, at least.
Yeah. The problem is, this is what people don't get. They're like, how has he been writing for this long? No, the answer is he probably didn't write for about 7 years, okay? Until COVID happened, he was writing on stuff he had left over from, like, previous books, and he wrote probably a little bit at a time. That's probably the issue here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he sort of had an idea for like, oh, at the end of the third book, he had an idea of where he wanted to get to. And he's been writing to get to that idea for 3 books now. And one of those books is Feast for Crows, which was only made because he had too much to put into one book. And then Dance of Dragons, which is separated into 2 different volumes, by the way. A Dance of Dragons is 2 volumes. And still, he had enough stuff left over from that book that he put it into Winds of Winter, which hasn't come out yet. That's what I mean when the story is too big, is when your publisher keeps on saying, no, we're going to have to cut like 12 chapters here. You can put in the next one. In a book that already has like 75 chapters.
That's kind of how we ended up with Known of the Ninth, isn't it?
Yeah, Known of the Ninth happened because Tamsin was writing a lot and was like, shit, this is more than one book. Well,
yeah.
And I think that might happen again with Electo the Ninth. I think it might get split into two. Because it's been delayed, what, to 25 now?
I think so, yeah.
Now, I think we can just, like, if I may... I think we can just speedrun here things in, like, general that we see pop up that they're not, like, complete, like, turnoffs in, like, stories for us, but what are, like, some elements that affect you or, like, would be things that wouldn't make you stop, but you would go, that's pretty weird. This, I'm not enjoying this, or this is kind of, like, awkward from this author. Are there any elements that you've seen pop up a few times and make you put on the big thinking face, like, huh?
So I'm thinking in terms of things that aren't necessarily bad here and aren't necessarily habitual things either. Like on the topic of delivering too much exposition... Usually Brandon Sanderson is pretty good about that, but the climax of Painter?
Yumi and the Nightmare Painter?
Yumi and the Nightmare Painter, yes. The climax of Yumi and the Nightmare Painter is explicitly Hoid telling you what's going on. Because there just wasn't a smoother way to do that descriptively. He just sort of wrote himself into a corner with that. And it took me out a little bit at the time. It's not the worst example of doing that.
George Lucas, not good at dialogue.
No. Tamsin Muir... elected to write the second book of The Locked Tomb, mostly in the second person. This is often off-putting.
Yeah, I've read a couple of things now in second person, and I'm still not quite used to it. And by read a couple of things now, I mean like read and stick through and actually finish the dang thing.
Okay, you asked me a minute ago if there was anything I could think of for T. Kingfisher, and this is a little bit of a nitpick, but...
That's what we're doing here.
Yes. Again, not necessarily a bad thing, but may cause some stumbling over, which is the Alex Easton novellas have a pretty heavy use of neo-pronouns.
That they do.
Sometimes those are hard to wrap your head around sometimes.
In the context of the story, it's that the fictional language of the protagonist's homeland simply has a more extensive classification system when it comes to pronoun usage than most other European languages.
Do you know in Welsh there are gendered versions for the word cousin?
I did not.
Yeah, you would call a male cousin a kender, and a male one a kenifer. And that's with a C, because we also don't have K in the Welsh language.
Interesting.
Is there any author that, like, you don't like the names of their characters? Has that ever come up for you guys?
What do you mean?
Like, you're just like, the story or plot here is good, but your characters are just not named well. Sometimes that pops up, you know.
I can't say that's really usually an issue for me. I will say, Arkady Martin's, Desolation... No, it's Memory Called Empire and Desolation Called Peace. There we go. Those are the ones. The society that a lot of the book takes place in has some kind of unusual naming schemes. I believe it's pronounced Texaclani.
Mm-hmm.
And I could definitely see that causing some readers to disengage. Because when you're reading about an emperor called Six Direction, it's a little weird. I could definitely see that.
I just asked because, you know, as a DM, you have to name a lot of people and come up with names.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know.
Coming up with names is the bane of my existence.
And it's not even like, oh, I gave this guy kind of a generic name. Because you can give guys generic names and it by just feels right, you know. But you have to make sense. Like, if you have a bunch of, like, kind of unique names or these, like, fancier names, and then you have, like, this Midwestern Americanized name, I'm kind of like, huh? Like, mate, you've been going with, like, sort of English, like, proper English names here. Then suddenly come out with, like, a, you know, like, a very, like, this is this side of the Atlantic. I'm kind of like, what?
the Aerith and Bob effect.
You do experience that sometimes, though, don't you? It's like, oh yeah, this is blah 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 from blah blah blah, and he's the prince of blah blah blah, and he's like Duke. Is that his style? No, his name is just Duke.
I mean, that's not that odd.
It's a very Americanized name, though. And that's kind of the awkward part about it.
I mean, sometimes that happens on purpose. Like, if you have settings, if you have settings like Kill 6 Billion Demons, your main character is named Allison, and then her mentor is...
87 White Chain, I think. That's part of it. I think that's also a shortening of it.
Oh, it is. It's the angel names are wild.
It is 82 White Chain, born in emptiness, returns to subdue evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of the angel names are like that.
I don't know why I thought 87.
It was close.
Yeah. There was an 8.
Yeah. The devil names can also get weird, like COCACOL Estrella von Maximus III.
That's perfect.
Also, isn't that pronounced Coca-Cola?
It's pronounced as the letters of Coca-Cola. COCACOLA.
Oh, that's how that works. I'd seen something about that somewhere, but didn't really understand it and just went, whatever.
I will note I am out of time, so...
Oh, and
we are
out of time.
Yeah. So, Ian, do we have anything in the mailbag today?
We do not have anything in the mailbag right now. So if you want to send us hate mail about how we have slandered the perfect writer today.
Or if we've slandered you directly.
Yes. Send us an email. Our address is fanfictapes@gmail.com. You could also leave us a comment on our YouTube channel or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can't leave us a review on Spotify right now, but you could always leave us a rating there. You can also reach out to us on social media. We are currently only on Twitter for some godforsaken reason. Maya runs that account.
The reason being that I found it very easy to add another Twitter account to my numerous Twitter accounts. And have not gotten about making a Tumblr for the podcast. Anywho, we're at Fanfiction Tapes with a capital F, capital T on Twitter. We post about episodes sometimes. It's been a little minute.
What's on next episode, Maya?
Next episode is going to be about my favorite punching bag, who is also bad, which is why she didn't get featured in this episode, because this is supposed to be about things that like. Good people do poorly. And J.K. Rowling is just bad.
Yeah, so we'll see you for that next week.
Well, I am and have been Maya, pronouns she, her, and today I was joined by...
I am and always will be Dylan.
And I am Ian. Until next time, bye.